Hello, welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Today we're looking at how important dressmaking was to the lives of Australian women across the generations. But dressmaking wasn't just a domestic skill. For many women, it was a means to earn a living. In the age of protectionism, there was ample work for women in local clothing factories. And for the skilled dressmaker from colonial times right through to the post-war period, there was the precious possibility of self-employment and even a chance to teach. A Stitch in Time, Dressmaking in Australia is produced by Catherine Franey.
In the film Bright Star, about the romantic poet Keats and his love affair with Fanny Braun, Fanny's talent with a needle and thread is pitched against Keats's genius as a poet.
Men's room out. Poet's got to do a bit of writing.
My stitching has more merit and admirers than your two scribblings put together.
Goodbye, minxtress.
And I can make money from it.
Fanny Braun's interest in fashion and her own skill and talent as a needlewoman and dress designer are well documented in the historical record. Her collection of costume plates, her scrapbooks, and even some examples of her handiwork have survived the centuries and are now held in the London Metropolitan Archives. But this is exceptional. Mostly, sewing leaves little trace in the archives.
It's pitch black in here.
It's important that we keep this store in darkness whenever there's nobody down here. Because these are all organic materials and the thing that affects them most is light. So,
for generations of women, before the advent of ready-to-wear garments mass-produced in distant factories, sewing was a big part of daily life. And, as Fanny Braun observed, it was also a means for a woman to make a living.
And I can make money from it.
In Hindsight today, we're exploring the history of dressmaking in Australia as a practical necessity, a cultural practice, an aspect of education, and as a career for women. As we'll hear, oral sources are crucial for understanding dressmaking history. But our story begins before the advent of the tape recorder. For the colonial period, the sources which illuminate dressmaking history are fragile paper patterns, rare surviving garments, and early magazines.
The World of Fashion.
Ladies' Pocket Magazine.
The Delineator.
Madame Weigel's Journal of Fashion.
Peterson's Magazine.
At the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, curator Glynis Jones is showing me some of the treasures of colonial fashion and dress held in the basement store.
This one, for example, is called the Ladies' Pocket Magazine. This one dates from 1825. So this is how news about the latest fashions would get around. It would have been quite expensive to buy, so that was for women who were quite well off. And it would include in it these beautiful hand-coloured engravings of the latest fashions. It's telling you the cut, it's telling you the colours, and it's telling you the materials. So you could either make those yourself, or if you had a dressmaker available, you could show your dressmaker the style that you wanted and have that made up.
And all of this would have been hand-done?
Yes, at this time it's all completely hand-sewn. There's no sewing machines around.
And was the local supply of dressmakers and tailors a problem? Like, were there enough?
I guess in the late 1700s, early 1800s, it was quite difficult to get even the cloth for the clothing itself. And there was only, I guess, a small group of free settlers in the early days, and I think most of them would have learnt to sew.
Queensland, October 15th, 1863. My dearest Etta, You have no idea of the trouble it is to get a dress here. I told you I remade my black silk. The winter dress Emily sent me didn't fit in the least, and I left the making for another winter and did without, while of the two print dresses she sent me up, one I made entirely again and the other does not wash well. Annie wears that skirt of hers with a jacket. So you see, such misfortunes are likely to make one contented with any wearable garment. Ever yours affectionately, Rachel Henning.
From the 1860s, nestled amid the pages of fashion magazines, were paper patterns. But they were a far cry from the user-friendly paper patterns that came later. Dress historian at the State Library of New South Wales, Margot Riley.
They actually were just little white pieces of tissue paper. There's no markings on them. Now, if you're a sewer, you know how important all those lines and notches and the grain line that's printed on the pattern, so you know exactly how to lay it out on the fabric. Unfortunately, with the early paper patterns, you really did need to know what you were doing. So that was where you needed to take the pattern to a dressmaker who understood how to create the effect that was seen in the fashion plate.
Now, here you can see a pattern for a corsage for a young lady, which is basically the bodice of an outfit which would comprise a bodice and skirt. And you can see that each of the pattern pieces, it tells you what it is. It tells you it's the cuff or the back of the corsage, or the side piece, and where you should pleat it. But all the pattern pieces are laid on top of each other, which means that you have to then get your paper and trace each one of them off. It doesn't give all the different sizings that we'd have today in a pattern, so you'd have to also fit it to your size.
In terms of dressmaking education, how important were these kinds of patterns that came in periodicals?
This is just making it easier, really, because before you would have had to unpick other garments and work off other garments. So this is making it much easier for the home dressmaker and dressmakers to make a wider range of fashionable garments. It's kind of the democratisation of fashion because it makes fashionable dress much more accessible to a wider range of people.
David Jones and Company. Linen and woolen drapers, silk mercers, hosiers, haberdashers, slop sellers. We respectfully inform the inhabitants of the colony that our stock at all times comprises every description of elegant and useful drapery and fancy goods. The long experience we've had in this important branch of business enables us to import goods most suitable to the wants of the settler. Lowe's Directory of Sydney, 1847.
Most of the major department stores in Australia, David Jones, Grace Brothers, Farmers, to mention just a few, started life in the 19th century as drapers. In other words, their main trade and the backbone of their business was fabric.
Drapery was really the selling of textiles. When you were shopping in the 19th century, you didn't buy a dress off the rack. You would go into the store, you would be looking for black silk. And they would have bolts and bolts and bolts all up on shelves, and the gentlemen, sales assistants, would be pulling these bolts off, and you would be looking at the quality, choosing the weight, what you wanted, and then you would, you know, they would tell you the price, and you would order how many yards of this fabric that you wanted. So that was really what a draper was about. It was a business that was selling lengths and bolts of textiles.
But even from the earliest times, drapers sold some ready-made garments. In particular, a category of clothing known as slopwear. Margot Riley.
Well, slops were the beginning of ready-to-wear, and it really started with working-class men's clothes. Very cheap, usually cotton or heavyweight wool, simple shapes, not much tailoring, easy to make, simple, hard-wearing clothes. So we very soon had a slop industry in Australia because we had a convict workforce that needed to be clothed.
As retailing started to grow, these small drapery stores changed their status to department stores, and they started to set up internally dressmaking, millinery and tailoring departments. And then this gave really talented women opportunities to either head up these departments or actually work in these departments.
Well, here I am. I'm at the David Jones Archives. And the archivist, Barbara Horton, has pulled some boxes out of the store for me. And it's material relating to the dressmaking function at David Jones, which was pretty big and pretty important for a long time. Okay, David Jones Company, departments. On the ground floor, it's all about haberdashery, really, and fabrics. So silks, laces, ribbons, parasols, hosiery, gloves, trimmings, drapery. And then on the first floor, you've got millinery, mantles, costumes, blouses, underclothing, corsets, art furnishings, and so on. And on the all-important second floor, dressmaking, tailor gown making. So that's where it was all happening.
So I can pull this drawer right out, which makes it easy to access. And it's kept under tissue.
This evening dress is made by David Jones in the 1890s. So it's our earliest example of a department store dress. It was made for a Mrs. Grimley. With this piece, I think she would have gone to David Jones and selected the fabrics, and she would have talked about what sort of design she wanted. They would have had images of different dresses that they could make, and then it would have been made up to her size. So she would have come in for one or two fittings for the dress itself. Inside the bodice of this dress, you can see how beautifully it's made. It's actually exquisite. The bodice features all of this boning, and then it has this tape that you'd sit inside it, which would help cinch the waist, but you can see the David Jones label embroidered onto that tape, and also the customer's name, Mrs. Grimley. It's beautifully finished, it's beautifully made, and it's beautifully designed. So a very skilled dressmaker would have been involved in its production.
So these huge stores grew up offering women retailing experiences and also offering the skilled dressmakers avenues where they could pursue their professions. The largest department store with a dressmaking department that was established in Brisbane was Finney Isles and Company. He employed 50 women in the dressmaking department.
But the number of dressmakers employed in department stores was small compared to the number who were self-employed. Michael Morendi is a curator at the Queensland Museum. For his PhD, he had a close look at the role of women in the custom-made clothing industry in colonial Brisbane.
I trawled through every newspaper that was published in Brisbane from 1859 to 1901. And I started to discover how big this industry was. Like, it reached a peak probably in the late 1880s, where I actually found 1,000 names. And these names were all women making clothing.
Miss Wilde, Highgate Hill.
Miss Femister, George Street.
Miss Margaret Scott, Queen Street.
Mrs. Janet Walker, Adelaide Street.
There weren't a lot of job opportunities for women during the 19th century. Of course, dressmaking was quite well respected because it was all women together. There were very, very few men employed in these industries. Certainly in all my research, I only located one man ever being employed by a lady dressmaker, and that was Janet Walker. She had one male in amongst her 120 staff, and what he did was go down to the docks and bring the fabric up. And he would also light the big stoves every morning for all the irons, where they heated the irons.
Brisbane's leading dressmaker was Janet Walker. She was in business for 55 years, and she gave the department stores a run for their money, at one time employing 120 dressmakers in her Ladies' Emporium on Adelaide Street.
And take us into her workroom.
Oh, the workrooms. Well, the initial workrooms, I'd say, were quite small, and there are no descriptions of the first workrooms that she opened in Queen Street in the 1880s. But when Janet started to build a much larger business, that's when the lady journalists, they actually call them the lady editresses, that's when they started to describe the premises and also the workrooms. And it's really interesting because, as you can imagine, in the 19th century, work conditions were not that great, and this certainly surfaced when they had the Royal Commission in the 1890s into work conditions in both Ipswich and Brisbane. Janet Walker's workrooms got a tick of approval, and we can get some really good descriptions from that Royal Commission, but also, as I said, from the lady editress. And so she described, you know, the big tables that were in the rooms and the facilities that the girls actually had. There was a lunchroom, quite a large lunchroom, and apparently there was a piano in there, and the girls could actually, you know, have a sing-along during their lunch break, which I think is pretty good, you know, for the 1880s and 1890s. Now, if you had just left school and you wanted to enter the industry, you would be apprenticed to one of these professional dressmakers. Now, with Janet Walker, Janet would take on a lot of apprentices, and they were all dismissed at 6 o'clock so that they could get home while it was still light in Brisbane, because Brisbane was not the place it is today. There were a lot of alcoholics around. There were a lot of murders taking place. And Janet certainly didn't want her young apprentices walking around the streets of Brisbane at night, so she let them go early.
Decades later, in Depression-era Sydney, safety was still an issue for young female apprentices in the clothing industry, as Mrs. Birmingham recalled in an oral history interview in the 1980s.
I went to learn tailoring. I was apprenticed to tailoring. I was 15, just a shade, a bit over 15. We had to have our lunch in the workroom. And if you wanted to go shopping, you could go shopping in your lunch hour. We had 3/4 of an hour for lunch. But if you wanted to go shopping, you must ask the manager, and you must go with someone else. The younger you were, the more particular they were about. Because around the city, there would be big boats in port. And there used to be all sorts off those boats. And they used to have a great habit of hanging around the factories. And, of course, many's the time they would follow us. I remember one time we were up in Wentworth Avenue. We went up Wentworth Avenue where I worked to Oxford Street to do a bit of shopping. And I wanted to buy a new hat, and I don't forget it. I went into Reuben Brash's, the store on the corner of Wentworth Avenue and Oxford Street in those days, and I bought this new hat with my girlfriends that were with me, the two girls. And when we came out, there was these half a dozen sailors off some boat that was in port. And they followed us all the way down and Wentworth Avenue to where we worked and came up the stairs. We wouldn't wait for the lift, and we ran up the stairs to the fourth floor, and they followed us. And we flew in through the door to the workroom, and they tried to come in there, but of course there was the bosses and the presses and that, and they soon mastered them and got them out. But I have memories still, and I have photos of older girls and senior girls that were over the tables that I worked on.
In hindsight, on ABC Radio National, dressmaking in the lives of Australian women across the centuries.
The dressmaker has no special tools. A thimble, some needles, some thread, some silk, a pair of scissors and a flat iron are sufficient for her work. Janet Arnold, Patterns of Fashion, 1964.
Historically, men have been tailors and women dressmakers. This old gender divide dates back to the early modern period in Europe. Michael Morandi from the Queensland Museum.
You've got to go back historically, I think, and look at how this industry evolved. And if you go back to the 17th century and even earlier, making clothes was always possessed or in the possession of the guilds, the tailoring guilds, and these were run totally by men, and women could not get a foot into these guilds. And it wasn't until the late 17th century where the first dressmakers' guild was set up in Paris, and it was because a group of women basically pestered Louis XIV, because they were tired of being trodden on by the male guilds. And the laws were changed and they were allowed to actually make and sell garments to women. And women took control of this industry. Now, initially, they weren't talented cutters because only men were trained to cut the garments. But eventually, women acquired these skills through draping. And what that meant was that the actual garment patterns were created through these women draping usually the linings of the garments onto mannequins. And then they would use the linings as the patterns for the garments and they would eventually create the garments. But what was happening in the 19th century was men again started to move into this area. And because of the science and the technology movements of that period as well, a lot of men were going into this industry via drafting systems. And they were creating what they called scientific drafting methods, where it was all based on calculation and proportion of the human body. And you would put the measurements into these formulas and you would create the patterns on paper rather than on the mannequin.
The scientific method of cutting is based upon mathematical principles. No trying on is necessary with this system, so accurate are the measurements attained by following the rules laid down. No matter how irregular the lines of the figure may be, the bodice will fit. The Queenslander, 1884.
They also created really fascinating aids that were shaped like the bodices of different periods. And each section of the body, say the bust line and the waistline, they would have screws on these sort of shapes, and you could actually enlarge or shrink the shapes according to the calculations. And instead of actually drawing the pattern onto the brown paper, you would actually trace around this metal gadget after you'd put in all the calculations and screwed the bust measurements to the right measurement.
Science and maths were revolutionising the dressmaker's craft. And all around the country, classes sprang up to cater to dressmakers intent on learning the new techniques. In the 1880s, a Miss Fryer set up a school in Brisbane to teach scientific dress cutting. In Sydney, the first classes were held in 1887 at the Working Men's College, later known as the Sydney Technical College. A leading light in New South Wales was Mary Ellen Roberts, who taught from 1900 until her death in 1924. At the State Library of New South Wales, Margot Riley is showing me some of the textbooks Ms. Roberts produced.
The first one, actually, it was The Cutter's Guide. It was published in 1909, and we have a lovely copy of that.
I gladly published these rules for cutting out, which are the fruits of years of practical work, not only for the help of my students, but for the assistance of many ex-students who are now fellow workers with me, teaching in different parts of the country and trying to make rough places plain for the girl who needs the means to earn a livelihood.
And then she followed that publication up with Garment Cutting for Girls in 1911. And this one actually is in the original binding still. It's just a cardboard cover. So you can see that it's really meant for working girls to buy. It's not an expensive edition. It actually says half a crown. And then another little booklet, which I think is very interesting, is this little paperback book called The Dress Cutting Measure Book. So it says for students and pupils using the Cutter's Guide and the Garment Cutting Book for Girls, the two publications by Miss Roberts, in technical colleges and high school needlework or manual training classes. And basically it's just a little book in which you could put together all your clients. It has a space for the name and the address of the clients, and then there's a little schedule of all the different measurements that need to be taken in order to design a garment.
Bust,
according to Miss Roberts' system.
34 inches. Waist to knee, 22 inches. Length of back, 22 inches, waist.
There was a big concern that dressmakers were not able to fit the body as well as a tailor, and that was more the male trade. So this was designed to professionalise dressmaking, to bring it up to the same rigours and standards.
Dallas Feltham has written on the history of dressmaking and Miss Roberts' place in the New South Wales technical education system.
in the very early days, the teachers all had their own method of pattern making until Miss Roberts wrote her textbook and got it approved as being the only method. Some of the industry didn't like her book being the only method taught because they were using different methods. So they challenged. They didn't want these newfangled scientific pattern making ideas brought into their businesses. And they continued to employ girls with no training and no background at all. So that unlike the trades, where a tradesman had to employ an apprentice and they had to be trained, it didn't happen in the clothing industry. So it developed a sweatshop image, lowly paid, unqualified people. Miss Roberts was trying to change that with her textbook and with her scientific dress cutting, and she didn't succeed.
I went to work. I got a position in Wentworth Avenue, Sydney, to learn tailoring. I was apprenticed to tailoring. I was 15, just a shade over, a bit over 15, and my first salary was 8 shillings a week. And from there on, I started my sewing career, I suppose you would call it. We always had to do overtime before Easter and Christmas. And we used to be very rushed with work, and we'd have to work back. Well, we used to work from 6 o'clock till 9 p.m., that would be overtime. There were no such thing as penalty rates. We just got our ordinary wage for that 3 hours overtime. It wasn't easy. It was very backbreaking because tailoring is done on your knee. All your sewing is set out on your knee. And when you first start, your back aches very much. Even though you're only young, you suffer terrible with back aches. But as time goes on, you get used to it, and it's just everyday occurrence.
Interview with Mrs. Hannah Nethery, 41 Norman Street, West Wollongong, 21st of the 1st, 1987.
About 1980, I think it was, I took lessons at the Technical College and did dressmaking course. I did 3 years altogether.
Do you remember your father talking? Did he pay for you to go?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Did he talk about the money?
Or? He didn't say how much it was. He was happy for me to go and learn dressmaking.
Wanted you to have a skill?
Yes.
Was it a full-time
course?
One
day a week.
Yes,
that's right.
All day?
All day, yes.
And what did you learn?
Well, in the morning we learnt drafting and pattern making, and in the afternoon we did our sewing, cutting out and sewing, and then we would do.
And you were using
sewing
electric machines, of course.
No electric machines in those days.
The treadle ones.
But we didn't do much machining at the college. We used to do the machining at home, and we'd do mostly handwork.
And that was a 3-year course, and you got a certificate at the end?
Yes, I got a certificate from a dressmaking, and then I got another book prize for ladies tailoring.
Armed with her technical qualifications, in the 1920s, Hannah Nethery got a job as a machinist at the elite dressmaking shop run by a Mrs. Cook in downtown Wollongong. Then she set up her own dressmaking business at home.
Of course, in those days, there was no Coles or Kmart or anything like that where you could go and buy the stuff off the peg. Everything had to be made. And so, of course, I was one of the leading dressmakers in the town at the time.
And where did you put the shop down? In the basement?
Mother took a bed down out of one of the bedrooms, and I used the bedroom there for the sewing room. And I used to use the lounge room for interviewing the clients. And I'd use my bedroom then for fitting the people. So that everything fitted in quite well then.
And did you enjoy that?
Yes, I did, yes.
Didn't find it a drudgery to be sewing away?
No, I loved it, yes.
It is the proud boast of the Women's Handicrafts Department that most of the country technical colleges in New South Wales developed originally from isolated classes in dressmaking and allied subjects. Women's Handicrafts continues to be one of the most popular courses in the department. In 1951, new dressmaking classes have been established at Bar Medman, Burrinjuck Dam, Currumbong, Milton, Penrith, Tumbarumba.
Yes, well, my name's Dallas Feltham and I taught fashion in New South Wales TAFE for more than 30 years. I was like a lot of girls of my generation. I was born in 1940 and my mother was a sewer and so was my grandmother. They both taught sewing in the schools. They brought me up to sew from early childhood. And when I finished school, they sent me to East Sydney Technical College to do the Women's Handicraft Certificate course.
Dallas Feltham was training not for a career in the clothing industry, but to become a sewing teacher. This meant 5 years of country service, teaching dressmaking in the bush.
My first appointment was Narrabri, and I was the only teacher. Actually, I was appointed to Gunnedah because that was the base college. I was given a one-way ticket, which was normal. Girls from the city would be sent out to teach in the country and find their own accommodation, teach as best they could. Ideally in a college with other staff, but as I arrived in Gunnedah, the principal met me at the railway station and said that I'd only be staying one night in Gunnedah and he'd be sending me on the next day to Narrabri. Well, Mum and I had looked up where Gunnedah was on the state map, but we hadn't looked up Narrabri, so I wasn't too sure where I'd be going. And when I got to Narrabri, he showed me the local Church of England Hall where I'd be teaching and booked me into a hotel and then drove off and left me there. I had to do a circuit to Ballater, which was on the road to Moree, and stay in a hotel up there overnight. And the hotel didn't cater for women because it was a small country hotel. So there was no bathroom for me and they didn't really want to have me stay. There were no locks on the doors. I don't think the lock met even if there was a key. So the students paid fees and I had to sleep with the fees under my pillow and no lock on the door.
Who were your students?
Well, in the country, mostly it was just country women who wanted to make their own clothes. It was the culture of the time, and people believed in doing things for themselves. So they would travel 100-something miles to Tamworth and buy fabric and come back and make it up in class with me.
Were all your students women?
Yes, they were. No one thought that a man might sew. But there was a rural course and a sheep and wool course, automotive mechanics, and they could enrol as part-time students in some of those so that they could fix their own machinery, they could mend their own gate. There was a welding class. The men had the same attitude. People believed in running their farm and doing everything for themselves. But as things have developed, the government's policy now is user pays and people have their own career and then they pay for other services and use the services of people with other skills. So I think the TAFE colleges in the country have been wound down and certainly in my area there's very little left.
When you were teaching, did you have a strong sense of imparting specialist skills?
I did. I took a lot of satisfaction in a woman coming in who couldn't sew and finishing the year having made three or four dresses and being pleased. We'd have a fashion parade, sometimes in the hall where we taught, sometimes, well, in the town hall, and the women would dress up in the garments they'd made and parade and be very pleased with themselves. The first fashion parade we had was in the council chambers that had been renovated, and we set it up for a fashion parade and we had the parade in there. But the power box hadn't been upgraded either. And so when we were partway through the parade and some of the ladies went out to switch the urns on for supper, it plunged us into darkness. So I had ladies up on the catwalk not knowing whether to take another step in case they'd find themselves down in the audience. And the men were very prompt. They rushed outside and they turned the headlights of their cars on because the cars were angle parked facing in to the college building, and we finished the fashion parade by headlight.
Listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. And today we're making a stitch in time, looking at the history of dressmaking in Australia as a hobby, a living, and an education. Post-war, European fashion was knocking on Australia's door.
Dior said, we need to find more markets, and Australia was targeted. And the French actually paired up with the Australian Women's Weekly and some of the Australian department stores to bring exhibitions of French fashion out to Australia, which is really quite extraordinary. This is 1946 through to 1949, and these were runway garments, you know, haute couture garments, which were shipped by air out to Australia and then shown in department stores all around Australia, including Tasmania and South Australia. And this kick-started the whole garment industry because Australia had been in a bit of a lull as well. And here we had an injection of input from the centre of fashion for the world, which was Paris. Pierre Balmain came out to Australia and actually trained the seamstresses in the David Jones workrooms, showed them the skills of the haute couture. The garments were brought to Australia, licences were set up with department stores and with other Australian manufacturers, which meant that that trickle-down effect was much more immediate, coming straight from the haute couture into the ready-to-wear and then trickling down into the marketplace in Australia. And from that, with the relationship with the Women's Weekly, you got patterns for those garments. So if you couldn't afford to buy them in the store, you could see the pattern, you could go to your own shop, and if you had the skills, you could make those garments. So I think that's a really interesting microcosm of what was going on at the time.
So that's the beginning of a sort of a new chapter, that post-war period. What happened to individual dressmakers in that period?
Well, I think just prior to this period, you're getting the Beryl Gents setting up her business. She's trained, she was an apprentice, to a French fashion designer. So someone like Beryl Gents was already doing that when this impact of the revival of French fashion happened in the post-war period.
During the war, everything was so dreary, and every man in Australia dressed in grey suits with grey hat. Everyone wore a grey felt hat, the men did. And the women were very drearily dressed. I mean, we didn't know anything about fashion in those days, and I think I just wanted to give it a shot in the arm. Mm-hmm. And I quite often designed things that they thought I was a bit peculiar, I think.
From the ABC archives, Beryl Gents, who built her reputation as a first-rate dressmaker, or couturier, in Sydney after the war.
Think pink when you shop for summer clothes. Think pink if you want that kelp to shows. Red is dead, blue is through, green's obscene, brown's taboo, and there is not the slightest excuse for plum abuse or chartreuse.
But I think because of the publicity of this whole new look, the excitement about fashion, rediscovery of fashion, and perhaps the refueling of the Australian fashion industry, it brought a lot more women into the trade.
Think pink. Oh, just to think about it. We're warm as pink about
it. It was the first time glamour had come into fashion, and that continued right through the 50s. When Christian Dior did his new look,
and bought every dressmaker in the world copied that dress. And it was the first time that had ever happened. And I would just think of myself so lucky to have been asked to do those copies and to actually get Christian Dior's patterns in my hand. Because they were so feminine. The waist was pulled in, and if you didn't have an 18-inch waist, it was pulled into one with a little tiny little corset in under the garment. And you just looked absolutely marvellous. It was the most uncomfortable thing to wear, but you didn't care because you looked so good. But I loved making that nip-waisted suit.
The curriculum on offer in the technical colleges had some catching up to do. Speaking in the 1990s, fashion designer Jenny Key.
All I wanted to do was design, do the drawings, and in fact sort of do imagery. But the design course that I did in 1963 wasn't that sort of course. They really wanted you to learn to do the dressmaking sides of things, and that's what I was not good at. They wouldn't let me use the colours that I wanted to use. I can always remember that I wore very bright colours when I was even age 16. It wasn't considered fashionable, I guess, at East Sydney Tech in that time to wear bright colours. So they were very strict in saying that you've got to design it in navy blue or donkey brown, and they'd sort of give you a colour samples and say, well, this is how we want you to do it. And it really wasn't till I went to London that I sort of came alive in understanding style and the history of clothing. I mean, my whole way of being changed when I went to London.
Things started changing in the technical colleges too from the mid-1960s. The old curriculum geared towards custom dressmaking and meticulous technical skill was losing its relevance. In New South Wales, the Department of Women's Handicrafts became the School of Fashion. But if you wanted to study fashion design, as more and more young women and men did, you were better off in the design school, which was quite separate.
Because you're in the design school, we have to aim at being original. Now, when you start sketching up these designs, I want you to think of different ways that you can introduce different colours, different textures, different forms of fabric application, and maybe even a different print, just to introduce something that will actually make it different from what's happening in Europe.
Sally Gibbs started teaching fashion design at East Sydney Tech in the 1980s.
My first teaching job here, I came in high heels, tiny little shorts and a completely see-through mesh top. And I was teaching like that. Yeah, and the students had the same things on. Can you imagine? And over in the other building was the woman, we used to call this woman her suit because she had really hairy legs. She used to wear a little suit, a little pale blue suit with buttons and little handmade. They'd make them all, you know.
So she was the old dad?
Well, no, I don't mean there was one of them. I mean there was a whole stack of them. They used to call them over there, you know, the teachers were called Miss Williams or Miss Anderson, whereas ours called us Sally and Nick and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we would have sort of sex change students and, you know, it just was radical. And then here was this very conservative area where you had to do miles and miles and miles of straight hem, you know, like doing hemming and learning how to sew straight. And it's a whole different culture. And so they thought we were appalling and we all thought they were just from another planet.
The local demand for hands-on skills, of the kind that had been taught in TAFE for nearly a century, went into decline from the 1970s. That was when the government started removing the tariffs that had protected the local manufacturing sector. So the emphasis in fashion education in Australia today is on design and business. Curator of Fashion and Dress at the Powerhouse Museum, Glynis Jones.
TAFE courses still produce people with those skills, but because our manufacturing has gone offshore, people realised that it was more important to concentrate on design. That's what would keep our industry going. It's good because we now have some great designers. Over the last 15 years, we've gone from, I think David Jones would have shown predominantly overseas fashion in their seasonal parades, and today it's dominated by Australian designers because there's a great acceptance that we have really innovative designers putting out sort of cutting edge work. So we're now competing, you know, on design, and that seems to be our strength.
Making clothes for the family, of course, is a very practical activity and was honoured in the family for generations until it was possible to get things more easily from shops. So that I suppose must have been in the late 50s, in my late teens and the early 60s, that making clothes at home came to be a sign of someone who wasn't capable of affording to buy things in shops or something. So it was very, very much marginalised then. However, through that time, many women continued to value their ability to create clothing for themselves and their children.
That's the writer Carmel Bird reflecting in the 1990s on the meaning of home dressmaking in an age increasingly dominated by ready-to-wear. Barbara Berman is a dress historian based in London who specialises in the history of home dressmaking.
Since the early 1970s, lots of women have weighed up their time and resources rather differently and have decided that going out and earning money in different ways is more effective for them. So it is about the relative economic issues, I think. But I can't think that people would have put so much energy into home dressmaking if it didn't have values of various kinds for them, but I'm pretty sure it isn't purely economic. I think it's more mixed, more interesting in a way. And we also have to remember that the relationship with what's in the shop, you know, early ready-to-wear, the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, was really badly made. The cloths were unreliable, sizing was unreliable. You can understand why people would turn to it in a way to get better value and to make things that lasted longer.
In the new century, the reasons for home dressmaking might have changed, but the practice endures. Alison Reeve is a home sewer who writes a blog about making and doing.
Sewing is, for me, it's a lot of different things. Part of it is very practical. It's very nice to be able to, you know, take up the hem on a skirt and make the skirt exactly the length that you wanted, or to get something that to fit you properly that it doesn't when you buy it. And it's almost a philosophical thing. I feel that you have a much richer experience of an object if you've been involved in making the object and you've engaged with the whole process that goes from turning it from just being a piece of cloth into something that you wear as a piece of clothing that looks hopefully fantastic. You have to do a bit of maths, you have to do a bit of engineering, you have to use a lot of imagination because you're starting with something flat and you're trying to think about what it's going to look like when it's three-dimensional and how you're going to make it three-dimensional. And in that sort of imagination thing as well, I think there's a lot of dreaming that goes on, you know, how this is going to look when it's finished and where I'm going to wear it. There are so many places in modern life now where that richness of creating something is replaced by a cash transaction.
A lot of the people, they fed up really with the globalised manufacturing of fashion, the garment industry, and also the rather dubious environmental practices of both the textile manufacturers and the garment manufacturers. And so there are particularly younger people who are getting interested in recycling and individualising garments. I think that younger women really are enjoying this.
I really love having nice clothes, but at the same time, I'm aware of where they come from. I mean, one of the things about sewing your own clothes is you figure out exactly how much work it is to make a garment. And then when you go and buy something and you see that it's made in China or Bangladesh or Vietnam, and you think of all that effort that went into it and how little the person got paid and the terrible conditions that they would have worked in order to produce that garment, it does give me pause. And a lot of the time, you know, I might see something nice in a shop and think, no, I won't actually buy that. I will make it myself because it is something I could make myself and I should make myself. So for me, the ethics of it are partly to do with, well, the idea that I think, if you outsource all of that production to somebody else, you really should be concerned about the conditions under which they produce it. And if you can't do anything to change the conditions, then maybe you should produce the thing yourself.
Now, for younger women these days, I think there is a revival in pop-up classes and groups who just get together informally and help each other. And I think in a way it's quite interesting that women are making use of this new technology of the web, where you can set up a website relatively inexpensively and you can run classes online, or you can produce things that you send home for people to learn from and so on. So I think there is a kind of different feel to it now, but people do recognise you've only got to make your first dress, haven't you, to realise what new skills you would like to add. And I think people are capitalising on that now and getting on with it more outside formal education. So I'd say in brief that I think it's become informalised.
For me, the internet suddenly, it opened up a great world and a wealth of knowledge that I perhaps wouldn't have been able to access, or would only have been able to access very slowly before. I think the other thing that the internet has done is that it has created a whole new forum where people can show things off. So instead of just, sewing yourself a new dress and wearing it down the street and having anyone who you happen to bump into say, oh, that's a nice dress, you suddenly have a much larger audience. And that larger audience, I think, perhaps makes you feel that you're doing something a little more worthwhile, that it's not just a hobby, that it is actually a pretty awesome thing to be able to make something like that.
You've been listening to Hindsight here on RN. A Stitch in Time, Dressmaking in Australia, was produced by Catherine Franey, with technical production by Lila Schunner. Thanks to Deborah Beck and the National Art School Archives Collection for their permission to use excerpts from a film about the East Sydney Technical College. Next week on Hindsight, a feature which explores the link between madness and modernity. In the early 20th century, the understanding and treatment of mental illness was transformed in the wake of radical new ideas, including those of one Sigmund Freud. That's Madness and Modernity on Hindsight next week, here on RN.